Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 8, delivered on February 12, 2018. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. Before I do that, I want to bring up one more topic with respect to present values of future expected cash flows. Annuities, as you recall, are streams of cash, more than one. If it's regular, then they occur at predictable periods, the same period. And if it's ordinary, the payments occur at the end. And if it's an annuity due, they occur at the beginnings of the periods. These have so many applications in the real life of businesses, in finance, but not just in finance, in so many ways. We need to bring back money from the future to the present, or we need to put money here and find out what its future value is. And annuities are the way we do it. And a lot of times we'll model something as a regular annuity or something like that so that we can get to the end point and price something. I want to start with something that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with this subject of annuities, but it is has everything to do with it. Now, remember that a company's funding can be through equity or through debt. We'll talk about debt in more depth in next week. Well, actually, this week too. But here on the equity side, a company has different flavors of equity. Now, there's internally generated equity, which is what the money that you earn at the bottom line that belongs to the shareholders. That's the internally generated. That's the one that has to be the long haul. You got to earn money for your shareholders and either pay it to them as dividends or plow it back into the company. That has to happen. However, so in other words, there's this internally generated equity here that belongs to the shareholders after it's satisfied its debt holders in a timely fashion. However, most people, when they think of equity, they're thinking of stock. As a matter of fact, you'll hear me say an issue of equity or equity in the company or something like that. Now, when people say equity, they usually mean common stock. But that's not the only kind of paper that represents an equity position. And you've seen everything I've done up to this point was with common stock, but there is another kind of stock that exists. It's equity, it's not debt, but it has some of the features of debt. It used to be quite popular, but anymore, you hardly ever see it being issued except in certain very narrow industries. To do this, though, I'm going to pull up just for the stock and have a look at the market for the day, see how catastrophic things have been. It was an up day, if I recall. As you can see, the market had a better day today. It wasn't, and it was across the board. Notice that it was all boats rose, although it looks like, well, not really. It was actually a fairly even day across the markets. The Russell 2000 didn't go up as much, but nevertheless, the market as a whole had a positive day. So what I would want to do is let's look a little bit closer at this day. And as you can see, giving it a decent little quick analysis, the Bears were in control after the bell for a while. Looks like the Bulls started to charge out, and then all of a sudden the Bears came and slapped them around. So we had the Bears running the show in the morning. But then about mid-morning, the Bulls came back in, did a nice push upward, and then it was flat. And then there were a couple of rallies and then sell-offs and rallies. But then at the end of the day, I'll be a darned if you didn't have that ending sell-off again. You see how that notch is showing up a little too often for my taste. It just keeps the Bears, once those Bulls have gotten their taste, then the Bears just step right back in and lap up the honey. Now I'm going to show you something interesting here. Let me look at the 1 month chart. I want to show you something. Now this is called technical analysis, and technical analysis is actually abominable. You shouldn't do it. But there are a few things within technical analysis that are worth keeping your eye on. The elves, as we call them, would condemn me. Technical analysis is all there is. No, it's voodoo. But there are a few things in voodoo that actually work. For example, I've seen a shrunken head. It actually was shrunken. That's voodoo. That's hoodoo. But look at this. Over the past month, do you see those declining tops? Do you see them? That is a technical analyst's tool. Looking at whether the tops are declining or rising. Looking at whether the bottoms are rising or declining. In this case, every rally over the past month, notice first of all that there was just not much movement at all for quite a while. And then in the past couple of weeks, every time the Bulls have fought their way back, they have not gathered as much ground as they did the last time. The declining tops is a classic symptom of a market that is sick, that is not going to do well over a long period of time. I see these declining tops, and I say, well, clearly the Bulls just don't have enough in them to recover all of the ground that they have lost in previous lows. And I also, even troublingly, see those two bottoms, those declining bottoms. Now, there's not enough data there, evidence there for me. I'd have to look at a little bit longer time period. I might look over 6 months for that. But right now, just look at this. I see declining bottoms, declining tops. That is a double whammy. That's a signal that the market is not well and that the market is going to ultimately slide further. And it's going to keep. And I'll show you a few other things about this, too. What you look for is when there are challenges to the neckline. This, if you print this, classic tool, you print this out, and then you take a ruler and you draw a rough neckline across the declining tops like that. And what you do is you look at whether the market, when it tests that neckline out there further, does it break through it or does it chicken out? You'll often see in a bear market, a long-term bear market, you'll see the Bulls test the neckline over and over again, but they will never get back to it. As the neckline drops farther down, the Bulls just keep trying to push it, but they just don't do it. And if you see the declining tops, that's that you create your neckline. And if it's declining, that's the problem right there. But if you see the Bulls testing the neckline out farther after you draw on your neckline, if they keep coming up to it, testing it, challenging it, and they can't get through it consistently, that's a recession. That's a down market. That's a market that you need to start thinking about getting your portfolio realigned to defensive. This is a technical tool, and I'll show you a few of them. I don't buy the technical analysis in its whole. It's just kooky stuff. But things like this are time-honored, and even we who are more fundamentalists are watch this, and right now, year to date, oh, see that neckline coming down there? You can see it. See how it was just this, the market really didn't have a lot of momentum since the beginning of the year. Do you see that there was this, it was almost drifting upward. It wasn't that hard, strong rise, looking out a full year. Do you see that? That was that. And if you look out 5 years, you had this long haul of a strong market upward. And now here, we're beginning to see bull market's over, probably. That doesn't mean there won't be up days. There was one today. And you'll see some up days, a chain of up days, and you'll hear, hallelujah, that was it was just a fluke. No, it's not. No, it's not. We got too many problems, and now we got the interest rates rising. And one of the things that we're going to talk about today and on Wednesday is interest rates and their impact on stock prices and on the economy. What does it mean to have an interest rate environment that is rising with an expectation that it will continue to rise? That means a hint. That means bad things. So keeping that in mind, let me take you to a, just for lack of greater creativity, Netflix, NFLX. Now, when I show you Netflix or a company like Netflix, that price right there is the price of common stock, common stock. But companies, some companies have another kind of stock too. It's equity, and it won't be reported as frequently. And if you see a trading symbol that has a dot P on the end of it, that's the company's preferred issue. That's outstanding. Preferred stock used to be fairly popular. Preferred stock is unlike, okay, first of all, let me warn you about something that I might ask on an exam. If I say who has a residual claim and who has a prior claim, well, now the shareholders, that's common and preferred, have the residual claim. After the debt holders have been paid in a timely manner, what's owed to them for the period, then the residual belongs to the shareholders. That is the common and the preferred. So, but preferred has to be paid its dividend before common can be given a dividend. So there is a higher claim by the preferred shareholders than the common shareholders. That does not mean, don't put on an exam, well, the prior claim is the debt holders and the preferred shareholders. Don't. No. The prior claim is the debt holders. That thing with the common and preferred is a family is the family hierarchy of equity. They both have the residual claim. Neither gets anything until the debt holders have been satisfied with what they're owed in the current period. Make sure you don't say, the reason I'm doing this is because I've seen this happen over and over again. Someone will write, well, the prior claim belongs to the debt holders and the preferred shareholders, and then after that, the stockholders can be paid. Don't. First of all, saying the stockholders, well, you just said preferred shareholders. They are stockholders. And the prior claim does not belong to anyone but the debt holders. But within the equity class, the common stock doesn't get anything until and unless preferred stock has been satisfied with its claim. I'll show you how that works. I'll do a simple, quick example. ANF, 1.5% cumulative preferred preferred par value $40 per share. Now, and this could have different numbers here. What this means, and this would be right on the preferred stock certificate. This means that if you hold a share of ANF cumulative preferred, every year you will get $40 for every share times 1.5%. In other words, every year you will get a check for every share preferred for 60 cents. Period. Forever. And ever. It is a guarantee. If the company can pay it, you will get it. Now, if the company cannot pay it, first of all, it can't give the common shareholders a dividend. If it can't pay its preferred, it cannot pay its common. Moreover, in this case, it's cumulative preferred, which means that if it, in order for it to ever pay a common dividend again, it has to catch up all of its back preferred dividends. Cumulative. It is very similar. Notice how it has similarities to a bond. It's a guarantee. Like a bond has a coupon that's stated on it. Preferred has a dividend that is stated, the amount of the dividend, just like a bond would. Unlike a bond, though, where the bond eventually matures and it's paid off and all that, the preferred goes on forever. It's just what we call a perpetuity, a cash flow stream that is infinite. A perpetuity is a level regular annuity that lasts forever. The company, yeah, you, madam, buy a share of this preferred. You collect it your whole life. When you die, your heir gets it. And when she dies, her heir gets it. When he dies, his heir gets it forever and ever and ever. Remember that a company, and this will be important for a little later too, remember how I said that corporations are not like humans? Corporations have no theoretical mortality. Unless something happens to them, they will live forever. They don't die. So in other words, buying into this, if a company issues preferred, it's not like debt. They'll be finished with it someday. This goes on. You're married to this for eternity. Now, interestingly enough, preferred used to be issued by companies. It's attractive. Can you imagine if you are, this is almost like the perfect fixed income investment. You put your money into this, you know you're going to get a check if the company's healthy. You'll get a check every year. You will. And you, unlike a bond, when it matures, you get the money back and so you have to reinvest it. You don't ever have to touch this. It just keeps going. And so certain types of pension funds love these things. Funds that were private funds for people who would retire someday. This was a great thing to have because the money was just pretty much there forever and ever and ever. Keeps coming in. But oddly, they fell out of favor. And there were a couple of reasons this happened, but they did fall out of favor. And I didn't quite get this until not too many years back, that they just don't get issued anymore by companies. Now, there are certain sectors where you'll still see it. I find preferred, if I'm searching for preferred stocks, I will see them in real estate, companies that are real estate development companies, like REITs. They'll do preferred stock. That's a lot of where you'll see preferred stocks. You can even type into one of these investment services, preferred stock, gainers, losers, something like that. And a lot of those companies will have something about real estate in their names. So they're popular there. But other than that, what's even odder about it is that it was a couple of years ago, I took my finance club students up to a couple of places in Chicago for the field trip, and we went to a designer house. It's a place that creates different portfolio packages that they then lease to brokers. The brokers use these for their different clients. So they might make one that's high yield, in other words, risky stocks, and that would be a product that the broker would sell to, for example, you, and then we'd have something that was a balance between high yield and dividends. And the broke, we'd sell that to brokers who had clients like you, who had that kind of risk tolerance or preference, investment preference. So this was a house that did those kinds of product designing. And kind of a cool thing that they did. And I've had students say, well, can I get a job there? Unfortunately, so much of that is now automated with financial engineering programs that there aren't too many jobs available anymore in that kind of work. But it was interesting. The odd thing was we were having this speech by the bigwigs of the company, the designers themselves and the CEO. And the designer was talking about, well, he gave an example. He said, we needed a product that would create, that would provide high dividends and very hardly any growth, just very high dividends, because it's big popular because a lot of baby boomers are coming toward retirement. They want more of these fixed income kinds of things. And we didn't want to go to debt instruments. We wanted this to be in the equity class. And they talked about how they just tear themselves up looking for these companies that pay high dividends and you don't see any growth of the stock price itself. And I finally, he finished that, and I raised my hand. I said, well, why are you doing this when you could buy preferred stock that does exactly what you're describing? You could create a product that was nothing but preferred stocks, a diversified 30 stocks in it. And he looked at me like I'd asked him why he doesn't eat turd sandwiches. Why would we do that? Because it's exactly what you're describing. And then he kind of gave me this thing like, well, we don't, people don't do that anymore. Responsible investment houses don't use preferred stock anymore. In other words, you stupid slob, you're not with the times. You know, yeah, it's sort of like I brought this guy in last year to talk about appropriate business attire. Someone asked him, well, what about pockets on shirts? And he said, only old guys wear pockets in their shirts these days. And everyone looks at me, you know, really? Anyway, so I'm behind the times in a lot of ways. I don't get it personally, but I do. Here's the flaw in a preferred stock. It has to do with inflation. The par value is not indexed, hardly ever. I don't know if I've ever seen a preferred with a par that was indexed to inflation. So in other words, as inflation roars, your par value stays flat. And therefore, your dividend doesn't grow with inflation. And the other bad part about inflation is that inflation starts embedding in market expectations of yields. So what would have been a great 1.5% in a low inflation environment, in a high inflation environment, that same real interest rate is going to be a nominal interest rate well above 1.5%. So you're getting a double whack here on this with preferred. It's inflation, it's not inflation robust. Robust is the word that it is not affected. And we would say that this is not robust. Preferred stock in general is not robust to inflation. That's a danger right now, especially. I've been warning that we were going to have inflation, and yeah, now the markets are suddenly getting all kinds of excited that that's about to happen. So anyway, other than that, though, preferred stock, it doesn't hurt. Generally, preferred stock, one thing about preferred stock, the price of it will never grow continually. It floats around its par value forever. It just floats there. Now, here's the formula. It's the present value of a perpetuity, which is how we can price the classic perpetuity, the preferred stock. The formula is gruesomely simple. The price value or the present value of a preferred share is going to be that flat dividend, the money amount of it, divided by what the market thinks the discount rate on that risk level of that preferred stock is. That is the market's discount rate for this issue. And notice, if you don't notice it, notice that I'm using the more technical terminology. I'm saying issue. That's the fancy word for this preferred stock. Okay. So watch what happens when I use the formula here. Now, for this ANF 1.5% cumulative preferred par value of $40 per share, the price of it would be the 60 cents, that flat dividend, over. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to say that the market discounts right now. What the market says this should pay is, let's say, 1.2%. Okay? So what I would do is I'd take the 0.60 divided by 0.012. Notice that in real math, we have to use the decimals. Recall that I said in those financial calculators, you almost always key in a percent. Well, this is back to real math, the ancient classic stuff, so you have to use the decimals. And if I crank that out, I would get 0.6 divided by 0.012. $50 a share. Now that makes sense because you see the market is actually saying this stock, this preferred, in the current interest rate risk level environment, this preferred stock should pay about 1.2%. It's paying 1.5%, so the market participants are going to drive towards this. Their demand will go up, price will go up. So this will go up to about $50 a share. However, this was with 1.2% on the discount rate. Now, suppose, however, that we had the discount rate go up to 1.8%, then now the price of this stock would be the 60 cent per share flat dividend divided by 0.018. Now, here we should expect the stock to be punished by the market because it's not paying a good enough coupon. 0.6 divided by 0.018. $33.33. So, as expected, the market says it should pay 1.8%, paying only 1.5%. So, the market's not going to like this one. You're going to see a sell-off. You're going to see the supply of the stock increase on the open market as sellers unload theirs. Supply goes up, price goes down. It works in a kind of good logic, and the more I say this, you'll hear me just say this over and over until you're tired of it, but this is the logic of the market. If the thing is paying more than it should, 1.5 instead of 1.2, well, the demand is going to increase for it. Price will go up. If it's selling for less, if the market says it should pay more than it is, well, then there's going to be a sell-off of the stock, and the supply in the open market trying to find buyers is going to increase. Supply goes up, price goes down, spank me. Now, look at what happens right here in the sweet spot. If the market says it should pay 1.5%, which is what it does, the present value of the perpetuity would be the flat 60 cents a share divided by 0.015, and if you do that calculation, it'll hit par. It'll be on par. It'll sell at par. Whenever you have the market and a security agree, it'll be par. That'll be true of stocks and bonds both. If the market and the security agree, then it will be at par. If the market says more than the security says, like in this last one, bottom one, it'll sell at a discount to par. If the market says it's paying too much, then it will sell at a premium to par. This will happen over and over. It's a mathematical principle. There's no opinion about it. It is just pure mathematical science. This is how it works. And there is no magic in markets that will defy gravity. Lord knows you can watch enough YouTube videos to find out that people who think gravity doesn't work for them, it does. There you go. That is actually the easiest pricing that we can do. Yeah. Well, it's not that it costs more. It is going to sell somewhere around par. Now, what you would probably... And so when you're with preferred stock, you're really not in it for a long-term capital gain. You're in it for that dividend. I mean, as the price goes up and down, it's going to... Its mean, its average, its expected value should hang on the $40. It'll go up and down around that. But as some kind of an expectation that if I hold it long enough, it'll be at $100. No, it'll never do that. It'll always stay somewhere around its par. Now, there is a play, though. If you are in a high interest rate environment, but you think interest rates will fall, see, in a high interest rate environment, the stock is going to sell at a discount to par. If you think that interest rates are going to fall, there is a play there for a little capital gain on preferred stock if you want to do it. But it's probably not much of a good idea. You're not, if you want investments that pay money, well, that's going to be something else entirely. That's preferred stock. And it's still out there, but you just don't see it in portfolios, and it's not going to be recommended too much. Although I do know, I did consulting for an REIT, a real estate investment trust, some years back. They're a weird animal, and they're being abused now by corporate players. They were supposed to be something to help develop shopping malls, strip malls, housing developments. Now they're being used for all kinds of bizarre stuff by the big, huge mega banks. But back in the day, what they would do is when they found like a shopping mall that they wanted, this one wanted to buy, I was consulting for, they would call Nomura Securities and just say, we want to buy this, it'll cost us $6 million, and they would issue preferred stock to Nomura every time they wanted to buy something. It was preferred. That bank in Japan was simply, it wasn't a financial institution, it was simply investing in serially in preferred stock that would pay it a dividend constantly forever and ever and ever. It was also doing common stock too, but I mean, you just don't see that much of it anymore. Now, there is a twist on the perpetuity, the level perpetuity, and we can use that to price some common stock. Not all, but some common stock. Some, you take your best guess, we use the formulas I'm showing you here, by the way, today. They are actually still used in practice a lot. I mean, software was written decades ago, and it's still used to price with this, the two that I'm going to show you, the level perpetuity and then a constant growth perpetuity, which comes next. Now, some of the big houses have gone to this insanely complicated new way of doing it that involves math that's literally PhD level math. I was involved in that when it was first starting to show its head back in the 80s, and now it's starting to be used. But a lot of houses are still using to this day, and probably will for another decade or two, probably even 20, 30 years out, they'll be using what I'm showing you here. Now, before I do that, let me go back to Netflix. And Netflix, okay. Let me look at Netflix here just to keep you familiar with screens. Netflix had a really good day, 3.4% increase in the stock price. And notice how it bucked the market. Do you see at the end of the day, remember how the market as a whole took a whack at the end of the day as the bears roared back in? Netflix bucked the trend. But then again, let's have a look at Netflix by the numbers. Humor me, madam. Is this a risky stock or a not risky stock in a well-diversified portfolio? Yep. Yes, why? It is risky. How do you know that? Yeah, don't be quiet. Assert yourself. You know the answer. You're better educated than almost anyone else except me. Beta is 1.57, fat boy. That's what you say to me. Oh, fat boy, I don't know. That's a cupcake, too, you know. I was being very existential. I stood on a street corner. I said, why am I here? Someone driving by said, because you got off the wrong bus stop, cupcake. I hate existentialist thought. Okay. Now, 1.57. That is considerably riskier than the market. In other words, this is more than half again as risky in a portfolio as the market itself is. So it's going to magnify by 50% in a well-diversified portfolio. In a well-diversified portfolio, it will show 50% more volatility, non-diversifiable risk, systematic risk, than the market itself will. So Netflix, here's step one that tells you Netflix is a risky stock. Step two. Yeah, let me try this. Sir, step two. What's the P.E. ratio of this stock? 206.36. Now, this one might be a little bit more complicated for you to do, but I'll see if you can remember. Madam, do you remember what I said was a normal P.E. ratio range? I kind of mentioned it, but I don't know if it caught. Do you remember? You? I mean, back in my time, 15 was a pretty steep P.E. ratio. 30, OMG. 60, WTF. 100, FTS. Okay? Fancy that stock. Okay. Really? Not even, whatever. Okay. This is, I mean, nowadays, a PE ratio of 30 to 50 is not odd, and I've gotten used to it. This is 206. This is 206. That means, and I'm going to say this again until I keep repeating things to get you to more comfortable. The price-earnings ratio is simply, in this case, saying that prospective investors are willing to pay $206 for a claim of $1 of residual cash flow. Another way of putting that is that investors are saying that every $1 that belongs to the shareholders is going to create a present value of future dollars for shareholders of 206. That's a lottery ticket. You're saying, okay, the company just earned $1 that belongs to the shareholders. We think that that $1 is going to create as a present value of future dollars that belongs to the shareholders, 206. That is very high. That is steep. That is nosebleed high. That is, if I see the space station going by, I'm going to be looking at the guys in it and the women. Okay? That is very high. That's risk. That's risk. Now, there's one other thing there that tells me there's a lot of risk in this stock. Well, at least it's abnormally risky compared to some others. And I don't know if you would see it or not. Does anyone see the other risk factor in this stock that's, or something that tells me there's risk in it? Madam, how much is the dividend they're paying? What do you see? Yeah, it doesn't pay a dividend. No, it's not a trick question. They don't say zero. They just say NA. Whenever something cannot be calculated or it's a negative or something like that, most of these programs just say NA, not applicable. It doesn't pay a dividend. So in other words, you are riding the prospect of capital gains. That's the only way you're going to make money off this. You see, normally with typical stocks, you get your capital gains return, the price you buy it at minus the price you sell it at minus the price you buy it at. And you also get that dividend yield, the money that you sent as a check as a dividend. In this case, ain't no dividend. They're plowing all of the money back into the company, so you've got to hope that this stock is going to go up in price, because that's the only way you're going to ever see a dollar out of Netflix. Now, let's talk about that. The one that really has gotten me about Netflix, and don't get me wrong, I'm not giving Netflix a sell at all, but here's the thing that is really causing me concern. Okay, see the price, see the projected one-year target price? $286.27. Say, $265. Wow. Ooh. And they still haven't put me in a home yet. Seriously, people, don't fight it. Just go to that place. They have meals three times a day. Okay, so right now, okay, so remember that formula, N minus begin over begin? So we're going to do that here and see what the target one-year return on this stock is. 265.27 NFLX 265.27 minus the beginning price, N minus begin, $257.95 over the beginning, $257.95. So let's see what the one-year estimated yield on this stock is. Oh, there's my calculator right there. Okay. Okay. Open parenthesis. 265.27, 5.27, minus 257.95, 257.95, close the parenthesis, divided by 257.95, 2.84%. Now, if there were a dividend yield, I would add that to this capital gain yield, one-year capital gain, and the sum would be. But this doesn't have a dividend yield, so this is the entire return for a year. Now, I want you to talk to me. Madam, a return of 2.84% expected on a beta of 1.57 and a P/E ratio of 206, with no dividend being paid, does that look like a good annual return on a stock, that stock? You're shaking your head. Say it for the microphone.
I think no.
But don't say I think. Don't ever say I think. That's weakness. Yeah. You say no.
No.
No. That you find this stock listed on thatsucks.com. I mean, this is not a good yield. This is an awful yield. For that level of risk, I mean, you can get a treasury note that's not on that. That's risk, almost riskless. My goodness, that is an awful yield. And a beta of 1.57, that's like saying you're going to ride the meanest bull in the world, and if you actually survive 5 minutes on it, we will give you an Oreo cookie, double cream. Yeah. Meanwhile, you're hoping the medics will get there and so you back up. Okay. That's bad. That is, and I want to make sure that you're getting to this point where you can see how the numbers are right there. Most people can't do this. Probably 90-95% of the population couldn't do what I'm showing you here, and I'm trying to get you to the point where this becomes... You become comfortable with looking at this basic information about stocks. Okay. Now, Here's the thing, though, that companies aim... Yeah, go ahead. On this son of a dog, I'm going to do something. You'll see me teach it later, but I'm going to show you something here. Current yield on a treasury bill would be about 1.8. I'm just pulling rough numbers. So the return on NFLX that I would probably aim at would be about 1.80% plus beta of 1.57. minus the expected return to the market, which should be about 12% right now, minus the risk-free rate, 1.8%. Do that calculation real quick here. 1.8% risk-free rate for a treasury bill plus the beta, 1.57 times, open parenthesis, an expected return to the market portfolio of 12%. Minus that risk-free rate of 1.8% represents the magnification of the expected market premium over risk-free, about 10.2%. Yeah. That is called the capital asset pricing model. I'll show it to you in about 3 weeks. It's very cool. It can get you discount rates for discounting cash flows, for pricing stocks, for figuring out whether to say yes or no to a project that the company is considering investing in. And it's a very simple formula developed about... 50 years ago, and still there's almost nothing that can replace this simple formula for finding discount rates. So sometimes you're going to see me pulling discount rates, like over there, see how I just pulled discount rates out of my ear for those over there. You'll see me do that a couple of times tonight. Eventually, I'll show you, well, what I'm doing is I'm doing quick in the back of the envelope CAPMs, capital asset pricing model, forecasts of interest rates and yields. But that comes down the road, but that's where I would put it. I would expect Netflix in a year to be at about 10% growth over the year. I would expect Netflix at $257, about $25, $26 on it, about $283. I'd expect it, but the target that they're claiming with their analytics is calling for a paltry 265. Not, I wouldn't say this is a sell, but at the same time, I mean, this is a, more of what we call a hold. Just hold your position, and if it still is underperform, if it actually does underperform the market in a year, replace it in the portfolio with a better performer. So constantly you're rebalancing, you kick out things that don't perform well and put in things that are performing well. This is called skimming. And you're constantly refreshing your portfolio, punishing the losers, and then bringing in winners. And if they fail, then you kick them out. You just keep doing that, just like the big dogs do. Okay, now, I'm glad you asked that. You've seen a window into CAPM. It's really not a hard formula. That 1.8% is just I find a treasury bill's yield, and the 12% is what I have found the expectation of the market, the expected return to the market is. Right now, it's sliding hard. Even like 6 months ago, when I was teaching a year ago when I was teaching this same class in the same room. I was putting in there like a 16% return to the market portfolio, that 12%. Probably by next September, I will put in there maybe 7%, 8%, if even that. But right now, everything is based upon the now. Okay, now to get down to the other part of that perpetuity thing, companies... Let me give you a real-life example. When I was I might have already told you this. I don't know. A company I was consulting for, we had a meeting of the officers and directors. It was sort of informal, a little bit inappropriate without warning shareholders that this was going to happen. But one of the things that was brought up at the meeting was, well, is it time for us to start paying a dividend? It was like a Netflix. It didn't pay a dividend. It was just plowing all of its our residual earnings into back into the company to grow the company. Is it time for us to start paying a dividend? And there was generally an agreement. Yeah, that's not it might be a good idea. And I said, stop. Let's talk about this. First things first. When you start paying a dividend, you have to keep paying the dividend. If you start paying a dividend and then you stop paying the dividend, the market is going to paddle you. It is going to spank you hard because its prediction of what was going to happen, you failed it. Once you start paying a dividend, you are in the program. Worse yet is the market is going to expect you to grow that dividend year over year. And the closer you come to a constant growth of that dividend, the more the market is going to like you. Netflix is just spending its money on internal growth, just putting that the stockholders' money back into the company to grow it. Good for you. Now, Netflix might in a few years decide that it's going to start paying a dividend. It might be a turbulent dividend, up and down and up and down. One way or the other, there's going to be this time when the market is going to say, sir, it's time for you to start paying a dividend and give indications in your 10-K management discussion analysis or somewhere that you anticipate that this dividend is going to stabilize and go to constant growth in a few more years. Now, in your early years, I expect the dividend to be a little turbulent. Okay, it's like you. You're still young, and you're still doing things that are very dangerous. Well, that one time, that YouTube of you climbing up the Empire State Building and hanging from the top saying, hi, Mom. And then there was that time you used a jet ski to go across the Pacific with bull sharks chasing you. You made it. But it was risky. And I expect that out of you at a young age. Someone says, try this, and you try it. Rule one, don't ever try something that someone's grinning at you when they say, try this. Bad decision. But you're going to make bad decisions. If you live through those bad decisions, I'm going to sit you down at about the age of 25, 26, and say, son, it's time for you to be stable. Stop it. Stop doing that nonsense that you're doing, okay? And grow at a constant rate. Your income shouldn't be going up and down and up and down. Your contributions to charities should be the same. Grow a little bit every year. If you're a church kind of person, contribute to your church a little more every year. Constant. Make yourself predictable. Because when you are predictable, you are lower risk. And as you go, your risk goes down, remember, lower risk, lower discount rates, higher prices. Your value goes up as your risk goes down. The problem here in the College of Business is that we turn you, and I'm honest about, we're turning you into like almost like machines. You're responsible, you do things right, you don't get in trouble with the law and all that. The reason we do that is because that stabilizes you and the expectation of you is higher, so they give you higher salaries for this than you get if you worked at Walmart, where we expect you to come in someday with a piercing through your brain. Have you seen those ones that are putting diamonds, they're actually embedding them in the bone of your cheek and all that? What the hell? I mean, I know places, I've lived places where they just cut it out. Man, you got to dive in there, click. Ah, I would. Okay, anyway, listen. Constant growth dividend is critical to the process of pricing the stock this way. See this perpetuity formula? There's a variation. This is the level version of the perpetuity. The constant growth version is where the price now, the present value, would be the dividend one period out. Make sure that you grow that period, that dividend one period. If they give you the dividend one period out, then you don't have to use the 1 plus G part. So if I said they expect the dividend next year to be, then I just put that dividend. But if they say they just paid a dividend of such and such, I'd have to grow it one period. And then you divide that D0 times 1 plus G over the market's discount rate minus the growth rate. Okay? So what you would want to do here, let's say we have CNTL. Common, just paid a 25% per share annual dividend. Now remember, you look for the annual, get the annual dividend. That is expected to grow at a constant rate for the foreseeable future, at a constant rate of 5% per year. The market is discounting, is currently discounting dividends from the common at 7.8%. Now we can price it. Now we can price it. The price right now of CNTL would be 25 cents per share, grown one period at one point, because you're getting the dividend now. If you're being given the dividend one period out, then I wouldn't do the 1 plus G, because the dividend calls for the periodic dividend one period out. So over the discount rate, 0.078, less the growth rate of 0.05. Now we can price this off. Nothing too tough about it. Watch this. I would do 0.25 times 1.05 divided by open parenthesis 0.078 less 0.05 close the parenthesis equals $9.38 per share. See, the critical thing, though, is that pricing this way requires that you have a stable dividend that has a predictable constant growth. And that's why we tell companies, you got to stabilize your dividend. If we can't see a stable dividend, or if you don't have a dividend, we have to go to less reliable methods, which means you are riskier. And higher risk means lower price on your security. When you are not risky, I will pay you a high salary. But if you are very risky, I will pay you a low salary. If a stock has features that make it hard for me to price it, then I'm not going to be so favorable to that stock because it's riskier for me to invest in it because I don't have my toolkit to use on it. Now, here's an interesting variation. You'll see this on the assessments a couple of places. Sometimes it's like I said, we have companies that start with kind of a turbulent dividend. But we also see evidence that there will be a point where they will begin to stabilize the dividend. Like, for example, if we're here at time zero with a stock, and we're going to have, let's say, 3 years of unstable dividends before the dividend settles down to a constant growth. So let's say the dividend at first started at 10 cents in year one, then it went to 8 cents, and then it went up to 12 cents, and then it went to 15 cents, and then from there on, it grew at a constant 6% rate forever after that. We can handle this. This one isn't too hard. The way we would do it, and you'll do it in the assessment, there are a couple places. What you would do is you would pull these individual dividends back to present values on their own. Even out to year four, you pull them back and add them up, the present values of each of those individual dividends. And then, right here, I would know that it became a constant growth perpetuity. So this, I would calculate this as 0.15, the present value at period four. Watch it. It's one period back. The present value at period four would be 0.15, the 15 cent dividend now, or at period four, grown one period, divided by, let's say the discount rate is 8.3%, by 0.083 minus the 0.06. What that would do is give us the price at period four. Once I had that, I take its present value and put it with the rest of them. So what you have to do with that turbulent dividend, and the hard part, really the hard part, is getting it right where the present value of the clean perpetuity kicks in. Because I'm going to work it at this point, I need this one, and it'll bring it back to period four from period five's dividend. And then once I get that price, I can bring its present value back to the back to now and add it to this. Go. That's just this formula right here. 0.15 times 1 plus 0.06 divided by the market's discount rate, 0.083 minus 0.06. But remember, that's going to find you the present value at 4. So you still have to bring that back and put it with the fragmented pieces. And oftentimes, that's actually not that unusual. We'll do this in a lot of companies. You'll have a project where you've got really turbulent cash flow in the early years when its sales are up and down, and only later will the project stabilize and have a predictable path to the growth of the revenues from it. This is not that unusual to happen. Now, the last thing I want to show you tonight is a dark crystal ball. Okay, now, to do this, I have to tell you, first of all, when the government issues debt, we use debt yields on debt instruments as our sort of our forecasting tool for economic activity. We also use some corporate numbers too. But as far as government debt goes, when the government borrows money, it issues paper in treasury bills. And by the way, just to make sure that you don't lose a point for this in spelling, treasury here is with a capital T. This is a proper noun. If you don't use a capital T, then this could mean any treasury instrument, a treasury of a bank, a treasury of a corporation. With a capital T, it represents government treasury-issued debt securities. Now, the treasury bills, there are the three-month, six-month, I don't know if there's nine-month or not, and then there's the 1 year. And then the treasury notes. There are the 2 year, 5 year, 7 year. And then the treasury bonds. There are the 10 year, 20 year, and 30 year. Now, the yields will normally rise as the term increases. They normally do. There's something called the maturity premium. The maturity premium is simply a reward for risk of lending money longer than shorter. Let me explain this to you. You want to borrow money from me. For a year, I charge you 10%. Interest rates probably can't do much in a year, so that 10% is probably going to be close to what, you know, what I expect to be able to reinvest it. Here's the problem. Madam, you decide you want to buy a house, and you come to me as a lender for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. I charge you 6%. Now, here's the problem with me charging you. Here's where my risk comes in with 30 years. What if over the time of 30 years, interest rates fall on mortgages to 4%? What would you do in a situation like that? You're paying 6% on a mortgage, and interest rates on mortgages fall to 4%. What are you going to do?
Refinance, maybe.
Yeah, you're going to refinance. And so I was expecting 6% for 30 years. You cut me off. And now I've got that money back, and the best I can do is lend it at 4%. Now, here's the other side of it. Suppose that interest rates rise to 12%. Now, the typical homeowner flips a house in about 7 years. But suppose that in 7 years, you wanted to flip a house. You've now got 7 kids. Your ne'er-do-well brother is living there with his friends. And they keep coming out of the garage with a gas masks on. You want to move and not tell them where you live. Probably not even tell your kids where you live. But if interest rates are 12%, are you going to sell your house and lose that mortgage at 6%? No. Okay? So there's your problem. So the yield on longer instruments will go above the yields on shorter instruments. So that takes us to what is called the yield curve. And what I'll do is I'll show that to you on the first thing on Wednesday. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.